Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Cherries are having their moment right now. Keep an eye out for the varieties called Lambert and Lapin. They're really lusty, and they're good right from the stem. Or you could dip them in some sweet wine. But if you find sour cherries, try this new twist with pie. You see, cherries love almond, so you pick up some almond paste. You pre-bake the bottom crust of the pie. You cover it with a thin rolled-out sheet of that almond paste. Pile in the filling, and you bake. Now, the crust stays crisp, and the cherries pick up all that sweet almond exotica. I mean, it's summer. It's fabulous. So more is coming up this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Several years back, British food writer Nigel Slater, who, by the way, is adored in the UK and may soon be adored here, moved into a little house in London. Now, behind it, there was a scrappy piece of earth that passed for a backyard. In a moment of possible insanity, Nigel vowed that he was going to make vegetables grow there, out of the ordinary vegetables. Now, you have to know this. London soil is pure clay, so it's like planting in cement. So to make this garden, Nigel had to haul in yards of compost and manure through the house, no less. He dug and he double dug, he beat back the snails and the whiteflies, and in the end, Nigel had his garden. And now he can pull up 8 kinds of potatoes for salad. He writes about the garden and his cooking from it in the book Tender, A Cook and His Vegetable Patch. Nigel, good to have you back with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
How long have you been gardening?
When I was a little boy, I pestered my father for a little bit of garden I could call my own, and he gave me a very short strip of the backyard and said, "You can have that." And I was about 13 years old, maybe younger, and I grew carrots, which I completely forgot about, and they went to seed. And I was amazed when I dug them up and found that I could actually grow something. And you know, from that moment, I was pretty much hooked on growing at least something.
You write it in the book, and I'm going to paraphrase it. You say, plant a seed, watch it grow, eat the result. And instantly you've done away with much of the baggage that comes with our modern food supply. So is this why you garden?
I think it's partly why I garden. One of the reasons is purely escape and the fact that I can be doing something that doesn't tie me to my desk, and it is a little bit of freedom. But yes, it's also to do with that thing of having a connection with my food that I feel somehow it's part of me. You see, when I put a seed in the soil and when I see it grow, I truly am amazed that I've done it, that that little green leaf has come through the soil. And I think, you know, wow, I've done that. And as the plant grows, I do develop, I suppose, I want to say a fondness, but I develop a sort of nurturing quality to it. And I try to protect it from things like slugs and snails and from the foxes that come into my garden and roll about and things and crush them. And I know this sounds a little bit crazy, but when I've picked something that I've grown and I eat it, I truly think it tastes better than if I've bought it from a store.
Well, I think just the aliveness of it if nothing else, other than what you've done, you know, in terms of your own hands, it's right from the earth.
It's from the earth. It's from my earth, which I feel I've invested quite a bit in my earth because I've looked after it. I've weeded it. I've dug in compost and fertilizer a little bit. So I've got some investment in there, which is the joy of the physical thing of gardening, but also that thing of feeling that somehow, you know, this is mine and I can do it. It is an empowering thing, growing something.
Well, you've written this book by chapters on vegetables. Now, there is a vegetable I am particularly challenged by, and that is eggplant.
Eggplant, which we know over here as aubergine, is something that I would never have considered growing a few years ago. As our climate has got a little bit warmer recently, we're getting longer and hotter summers. So things that take a while to ripen, like eggplant, are starting to work here now. And it's one of those seeds that is very capricious. Sometimes it will germinate and sometimes it won't. It's that thing of luck, really. So I put my seeds into quite warm soil and I just keep it as warm as I can. Now, sometimes that means in the airing cupboard amongst all the laundry. And other times it just means on the windowsill. But as soon as it starts to form, the leaves start to form, then I really keep it out of a draft. I make sure the temperature is fairly regular. And I like the fact that I'm having to put a bit of effort into it, not like potatoes or carrots, which I can just put in and they kind of happen. It's something I've really got to think about. And then, of course, when it's old enough to put into quite a large pot, I find the warmest, sunniest place I can in the garden. And they actually do. They survive. Occasionally they thrive. And they're worth it not just for the eggplant, but for the beautiful purple flowers as well.
How do you work with eggplant in the kitchen?
Well, the joy for me of eggplant is the fact that it soaks up flavours like a sponge. It really is like a vegetable sponge. And I always use good oil, really flavoursome, fruity olive oil, because I know that that oil is going to become part of the eggplant. Mm-hmm. It actually becomes part of the texture of it. So you get this silkiness. And very often, I will either fry it or I will griddle it. When I griddle or broil a slice of eggplant, I do it fairly dry, and then I dress it afterwards, either with olive oil that I've put a few herbs in, or some lemon, or maybe I put a few sort of frizzled onions and some pine nuts and maybe some raisins or sultanas with it to give it a slightly Middle Eastern flavour. It can go whichever way you want to push it. You know, you can make it spicy, you can put herbs with it, it's entirely up to you.
Is there a variety of eggplant that you prefer?
I was brought up with the big purple, black, shiny eggplants. And I could never understand why it was called the eggplant in America. And then I started to shop in Middle Eastern shops and at farmers markets here in London. And of course, they have the beautiful little ivory eggplant that really does look like an egg. And it was so beautiful and suddenly all was explained. And I thought, well, of course, that's why, that's where it came from. And I think my favourite is the one that is, it's white, but it's just brushed with a little bit of lilac, a little bit of purple, and it almost looks like it's been put on with a paintbrush.
Nigel, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you very much.
Nigel Slater is author of Tender, A Cook and His Vegetable Patch, and Ripe, A Cook in the Orchard. Now, be sure to try Nigel's recipe for grilled eggplant with creamed feta. It's made for weeknights. Find it at splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, get registered for our podcast, sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out the latest edition of our ebook, Eating In with Lynn, Volume 2, The Big Summer Party. It's all there, you know where, splendidtable.org. You know, I guess the best way to describe Jane and Michael Stern is to talk about their philanthropic work. By searching for great food around America, they eat so we don't have to. They give of themselves to bring us only the gems. Jane, Michael, good to have you back, guys.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
What's the deal with corned beef hash?
I mean, this sounds like a Seinfeld episode.
No, this is really about something. It's an American classic, but you just don't see it that much anymore.
Well, unfortunately, you see it all too often on menus when it's not very good. I remember sitting down in a diner a while back asking the waitress if the corned beef hash was fresh, and she said, yes, I saw the chef open the can just a few hours ago. And we're not talking about that kind of corned beef hash.
Yeah, the kind that looks exactly like dog food.
No. There is great, great corned beef hash to be found around this country. One of our absolute favorite spots is a restaurant in Milwaukee that we originally went to for its fish fry, McBob's, which is just a typical corner tavern, or at least it looks that way. Mm-hmm. They've got a wonderful fish fry. They also make corned beef sandwiches, really good corned beef. I mean, they do it themselves. They corn the beef. But go there in the morning. It looks like the kind of place where they wouldn't even serve breakfast. But if you go in there in the morning, they coarsely chop up that corned beef, add some potatoes and onions, and it is one of the most delicious kind of rugged corned beef hashes you'll ever find.
Is there a secret here that if there is no corned beef on the menu, and then you see corned beef hash, you are probably going to get something that's come out of a can?
That's usually true. However, there is one restaurant that we've loved for years, the Laurel Diner in Southbury, Connecticut. They have corned beef hash on the menu, for which they make corned beef. That's the only reason they make corned beef, to make their corned beef hash. And let me tell you, it's a very different kind than McBob's, because it's much more chopped up. It would be mushy if it wasn't sizzled so crisp on the griddle. It's one of those, you get it in a patty, and the outside of the patty is real crunchy. But as soon as your fork cuts through the crunch, you get that kind of moist, juicy inside. It's great, especially with an egg on top, with the yolk kind of oozing into it.
Lynn, corned beef hash, like so many dishes, started as an economical way to use the scraps of corned beef
potatoes. The diner slang for corned beef hash, the old diner slang, is clean the kitchen.
Exactly.
I didn't know that.
But if you're not cleaning the kitchen, it's a very labor-intensive dish. You know, I mean, it requires many steps. And Michael earlier said something about the crispiness of the corned beef hash. And to me, that is the trick. There's nothing worse than soggy corned beef hash. It has to have almost not a charred, but certainly a browned outside.
A good crunch. And then the other big issue with corned beef hash, and I like it both ways, is it mostly corned beef with just enough potatoes to balance it, or is it kind of half and half? And I mean, either way is fine, but they're very distinct types of corned beef hash.
Also, red flannel hash.
Now, what is red flannel
hash? That is. Oh my gosh, that's a New England specialty, Maine, New Hampshire. Corned beef, potatoes, and beets.
And boy, is that good. Oh, wait a minute.
It's everything from leftover from last night's boiled dinner. You could throw a few parsnips in it, too.
I see.
What about Manny's Coffee Shop in Chicago? Have you been there?
They're famous for their corned beef. I mean, they're well known for their corned beef sandwiches. But go there in the morning, you get a sensational corned beef hash. That one, it seems to me, has more onion than most of them. It's kind of sweet in a nice onion way that you don't necessarily expect in corned beef hash.
And if you're near where we are in Connecticut, if you go to Pat's Country Kitchen on the Connecticut shoreline, you will find, and I can't think of any other place that makes this, clam hash, which is freshly shucked clams that have been cooked, and potatoes and onions. It's delicious.
No corned beef.
No corned beef.
I think you two should think about doing the Hash Chronicles. And in the meantime, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Happy eating.
Thank you. Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Now get their very latest finds on our website as well, splendidtable.org. There is another series of guidebooks worth a look. The Terroir series are by food writer David Downey. Now, David divides his life between Italy and France, so he's writing from long experience. His Rome guide was my first thumb through in the collection. David headquarters in Rome. He knows where food-obsessed Romans eat and shop. One example is Gino, the cult trattoria across from the Italian Parliament. Now, this is where the food is pure Roman and no fooling around with silly innovation. Order the pasta alla carbonara made the right way. No cream. Try the Roman artichoke stuffed with mint and the baby lamb cacciatora. That's hunter style with garlic, anchovy, and rosemary. I can't stand this. Somebody get me a plane ticket. Okay, we're going to be back with Mario Batali on a power trip. He decides if I pass or fail in a new round of Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know that tune. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things that they've got in their refrigerator. I have to come up with a dish from those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, the final judgment comes from our celebrity guest, Stumpmaster. And today, he is the chef who got the ultra chic of New York begging for pure pork fat. And for this and so many other reasons, he is one of the few people I would just love to have cook for me. He is the man of the orange clog fame, Chef Mario Batali. Hey, Mario, it's good to have you back.
It is a delight to bask in your golden sunlight.
Oh, I love you. So I understand that you are about to change food on television into something that we have never seen before. What is this about?
Well, that's the optimistic ABC way of looking at things.
Yes.
We are in the midst of creating a new daytime TV show that is about food, pop culture, nutrition, health, but all in a light, fun, interesting way, and it's called The Chew.
You know, this is quite a landmark. Look what's happened to food.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time to be in the food world.
Well, okay, we have got a caller waiting in the wings who wants to play Stump the Cook. Sarah,
mm-hmm.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from my office in downtown Toronto.
Hi, Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Mario, I'm great.
I love Toronto.
Yeah, it's a great food city.
It sure is.
So, Sarah, I don't know what's in your fridge, but these are the three things that I've heard about you. I've heard that you're originally from Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Understand Newfoundland.
I understand. Okay. And you're a bird watcher.
That's right.
And you work for a human rights and environmental organization.
That's right. I'm kind of the classic NPR listener, except I'm Canadian.
So tell me what's in the fridge.
I've got a bunch of rapini.
Great.
Rapini, okay, yeah. So that is the lovely broccoli relative. Go ahead.
I've got about a pound of New York State cheddar cheese, seven years old.
Seven-year-old
really
cheddar.
Crumbly and sharp.
Ooh, yeah, okay.
I've got in my freezer tons and tons of partridge berries, which are a berry from Newfoundland.
What do they taste like?
They taste, well, I always say they taste like if you crossed a cranberry with a mousse. Because they're
like a chocolate mousse or a mousse with horns?
A mousse with horns.
Okay.
Well, you may know them in Minnesota as lingonberries.
Ah. Oh, yes. Yeah,
yeah.
They're Scandinavian
yeah.
as well.
They're very rich, gamey, tart flavor.
Intriguing. Okay, so that's three.
Yeah,
four.
And then I have some homemade fish cakes. And
all right.
These are made out of salt cod.
Excellent.
Potato. And then I have a bottle of rhubarb wine, which I picked up for some reason in Nova Scotia a couple
so
of years ago
five.
On a trip. Yeah.
Now, is the wine sweet?
I haven't opened it, so I don't know, but I think they said you could drink it as a spritzer. So that leads me to think it's probably a little bit sweet.
A little bit sweet. Okay. Now, I should add, guys, I get freebies. I get water, salt, and pepper, and three things if you really have them, you know, in your house.
Okay.
Okay. So my job is to come up with a dish that
Sarah, you would really eat, and Mario, you think would be acceptable, okay? And I rarely fail.
So, let me just ask one question.
Sure.
I've only listened to about 50 of these.
Yeah.
But I've never heard them give you something already made. Like, the fish cakes is almost a layup, isn't it?
Well, in a way it is.
It's
but,
a leftover.
Okay.
Okay, the very first thing I want out of all of this is a tad of butter. Have you got butter?
Yeah.
All right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to cut up that rapini, and we're going to just drop it in some boiling water just for a few moments, just to give it a fast blanch.
Yep.
And then we're going to take a big skillet and brown that rapini in butter.
Okay.
Add some chopped up garlic and those berries.
Really?
Right? Yeah. Meanwhile, you are going to crumble up the fish cake into small bits. You're going to daub that with the butter, okay?
Uh-huh.
You're going to spread it on a cookie sheet, and you're going to run it into a super hot oven. What I want to get are like little toasty clumps of those fish cakes.
Like fish cake croutons.
Like fish cake croutons, great. Exactly. Small bits that are going to be crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, take that rapini out of the pan. Obviously, you've seasoned it, right?
Yeah.
With its garlic and the berries. And you're going to stir rhubarb wine into that. And you're going to do a reduction, okay?
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking the wine is a little bit sweet. Once you've got a really kind of creamy, intense-tasting sauce,
uh-huh,
take that sauce and drizzle it all around the pile of rapini on the platter. Take those croutons from the oven, and you're going to just, you know, sprinkle them over the entire plate and over the rapini. And then what you're going to do is take shavings of the cheddar and just shave a few furls over the whole thing.
Huh.
So you've got crunchy, you've got crisp, you've got that bite of the rapini, and you've got those kind of meaty, moussey berries. Okay, guys, time for judgment. What do you think?
Well, at what point do you serve this? Is this like a light lunch? Is this like a salad-y kind of thing or an antipasto?
I would eat this as a main course.
There you go.
Sarah,
your call?
You know, I never would have thought of the partridge berries with the rapini, but it seems a little intriguing.
I'm wondering how many berries we have to put in. I love broccoli rabe. I love the idea of a kind of sweet and tart component to it. If it was 80% broccoli rabe, 20% berries, we're good. If it's 50-50, more like a weird cranberry sauce, then I'm nervous.
I think the best part is the fish cake croutons. I'd do it.
And Mario?
I'm going to say that depending on the sweetness of that wine, if that's a nasty sour wine, your dish is kind of sunk. But I'm going to bet that a rhubarb wine is probably sweet, and I'm going to go with your intuition there. And I would love that dish. Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, yes! Oh, guys, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
I am polishing the crown. Sarah, thanks for playing. And Mario, what would you have done with it?
I would have done exactly what you did.
Oh, come on.
If I had to get really odd on that one, I might have actually pureed the berries and made them into a noodle because it's not so sweet when you make it with pasta.
What?
I would have maybe made like little fettuccine or tagliatelle and tossed it with the rabe and the fish cakes, very much like the way you did it. I don't know. I probably would have just drank the rhubarb wine, though. I don't know that it would have fit into my dish.
Right, exactly. I love the idea of the pasta, though. Hey, thanks so much for being our stunt master.
Anytime.
And we will be looking forward to the chew.
That's right. Thank you very much. I can't wait to eat this dish.
Hey, I'll send you a sample.
Excellent.
You can catch up with Mario every weekday on ABC's The Chew. Now, you want to take a shot at stumping me? Okay, you can do it. Contact the show with five things that are really in your fridge, and maybe one of our cunning producers will invite you to join up. Comics Mike Faverman and Pat Mack ran into each other on an open mic night at a comedy club. Now, to make a long story short, they discovered that they both love to cook and that they love to camp, but in their own inimitable style, which I have to tell you redefines roughing it. Well, they started doing comedy cooking gigs at RV shows around the country. Well, now Mike and Pat have turned all of that into their book, which is called Ultimate Camp Cooking. Mike Faverman, Pat Mack, good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, Mike, how do you guys go from doing stand-up to doing camp cooking, of all things?
Well, to be honest, I think we just combined our two favorite things to do, which was making people laugh and cooking and making people happy. You know, I mean, when I see people eat my food and enjoy it, that's almost as good as telling a joke and making them laugh. So to combine the two is just doubling up the positive energy, you know?
Yeah, but let's put this in some kind of context. I mean, you could do that in someone's kitchen, but you guys have elected to do this in the middle of, if you'll pardon the expression, godforsaken nowhere. I mean, you're talking out there where there are bears and trees and you know, there's no running water.
No. You know what was cool is that Pat and I wanted to experiment with this idea. So we did. We went out in the woods because Pat is an avid camper, and he used to build a kitchen out there in the woods, and it always drew our attention. So what Pat and I decided to do is we'll both go out there, we'll build this kitchen, and we'll see what happens. And it was amazing, the results. People just came over in droves, and, they were inquisitive. They were hovering around. They wanted to know what we were doing, what we were cooking, how we were cooking it. And it just ended up to be almost like an audience in the woods watching us. And it just felt fantastic.
So, Pat, what is it about this kitchen that you set up?
Well, if you stop and think about it, when you're having a party,
right,
everybody ends up in the kitchen. That's just the way we all work. So when you're up in the mountains, if you build a kitchen outside, that's where everybody ends up around. You take just a regular pop-up canopy, take a couple of tables, and you square them off, and then you put your grill to finish off the square, so you have a U-shape in there.
Uh-huh.
I have a collapsible cupboard that I hang from the canopy where I put all my spices and all my oils and plates and everything. Then I put my my grill box on top of the stove, as well as a griddle. I have a toolbox.
Yeah.
But my toolbox holds spatulas, spoons, corkscrew, and, of course, the top rack is filled with spices. So when you take that and put that up there, you're going to draw some attention. People are going to start to look over like, what is this? Is he selling something?
Yeah. Is he People going to start intrigued. Chopping, mincing, and telling you that he's got the miracle knife of the age? My home kitchen isn't quite that well equipped.
My wife always tells me that we do eat better in the mountains than we do at home.
So what kinds of things do you guys cook?
We cook everything. We cook, appetizers, desserts, entrees, soups, salads. I mean, we run the whole gamut of types of foods. And that's the thing about the kitchen is we have all cooking surfaces. So anything we want to cook, we're ready to go at any time. The misunderstanding for most people is they think that, having to cook these type of meals in the woods takes a lot of time and a lot of equipment and a lot of ingredients. And that's not the case.
You have an eggs benedict that you do with a Dutch oven and a pie plate?
Well, what I like to do is take a couple pieces of foil, roll them up into little balls, and then I raise my pie tin up inside my Dutch oven because I'm going to be using biscuits. So it's lifted up just enough so there's going to be a circulation of air underneath. And then I put biscuit dough inside the pie tin, and then I push it down with my thumb and create a little divot, put my prosciutto ham in there, cover it with eggs, unscrambled eggs, just regular cracked full eggs, and then cover it with Parmesan cheese. And then I put the lid on the Dutch oven, and I'll put coals underneath the Dutch oven and coals on top of the Dutch oven, but I never put coals directly underneath the Dutch oven, only around the edge. Because if you put it directly underneath the Dutch oven, it will scorch and burn the recipe. So if you have it around the edge, it's going to push the heat up, and the coals on the top are around the edge, and it pushes the heat down. So it creates a convection inside your Dutch oven, and it makes it really easy to work with.
This is brilliant. So you're baking the biscuits with the flavoring and with the egg on top. So do you have like a traditional opening night dinner?
Yes, Budweiser and Fritos. No, you want to make sure that your first day, that your timing's just right. So if you know you're going to be getting up later in the evening, that you want to make sure that you have a recipe that's going to be really easy just to throw out there, that's going to, you know, be ready to feed everybody. One of our favorite ones to do at the beginning of the camping trip would be a drunken flank steak, because you can marinate that 12 hours before you leave town. So when you get up there to camp, just throw it on the grill, and it literally takes about 40 minutes tops to cook that all the way through. But it, of course, drunken means it does have alcohol in it, and a lot of our recipes do have alcohol in them.
Just
in
a little way.
Just a little bit, you know, just to kind of
spice
bring the
it up.
Spirit of camping in. But a drunken flank steak is just basically Jack Daniel's soy sauce, ginger, crushed red pepper flakes, and lime juice to help. It breaks it down and makes it nice and tender, and then you just throw that on the grill after it's been marinating for no more than 15 hours, and it has a really nice flavor.
Wow. Hey, you, thanks. This is great fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Comedians Pat Mack and Mike Faverman are the minds behind Ultimate Camp Cooking. That Dutch Oven Benedict recipe? Well, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or email us at splendidtable.org. Linda is calling from St. Paul. Linda, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I am interested in some recipes for garlic scapes.
Oh, the garlic shoots.
Yes. The first time I saw them was about 2 years ago at the farmer's market,
mm-hmm.
and they were so beautiful, but I didn't really know what to do with them.
Well, they're those long green, they almost look like little tubes, don't they?
Yes.
And they're long and green, and they kind of curl, and they're the shoot that the garlic sends up above the ground, because the garlic head is underground, and they're more delicately, they taste of delicate garlic, essentially.
Yes, they're very mild.
Very mild. One thing you can do is you can just coarsely chop them and saute them in a bit of butter, and then just that, and salt and pepper, and squeeze lemon on them, because you'll get that pure, gorgeous taste. One of the ways I've had them done in France was they sauteed them in a little bit of olive oil, and then they sprinkled cherry vinegar in the bottom of the pan.
Mm.
And boiled it down. But they still had a little bit of crunch to them, and they served them that way. They're wonderful for a soup. You could take regular garlic and saute that slowly in a teeny bit, not a huge amount of butter, until it's really softened. And then you add some sliced potato, and you add broth, and you cook that until the potato is very soft, so you can puree all this. And then you chop up the garlic scapes. The garlic shoots, let's call them what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you cook them just long enough so they're very bright green, and you puree the whole thing. And what you essentially have is a creamless vichyssoise, but it's done with garlic instead of leek or onion.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and you don't use a lot of potato. The potato's the thickener. And if you want to use cream, you could use cream. And if you wanted to, top it off with a few peas.
Oh.
Or a spoonful of whole milk yogurt. Because the tang of the yogurt with the garlic is really delicious.
Mm.
Okay?
Sounds great.
You're off and running.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this week's trivia challenge has been waiting in the wings. Now, the new question is, what is London's newest take on the ice cream truck? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you some more in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email us, splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is London's newest take on the ice cream truck? Well, it's Her Majesty's ship, the HMS Flake 99. What am I talking about? I'm talking about an amphibious ice cream truck, and its route is on the Thames River. And Flake 99, by the way, is a famous ice cream cone in the UK. It has a stick of Cadbury chocolate flake in it. Now, here's real ambition, though. Flake 99's next stop could be the canals of Venice. Yes, they are planning to cross the channel. Now, why is it I can't get out of my head, one if by land, two if by sea? Okay, the lines are open. We're taking your calls. It's 800-537-5252. We have got Katie on the phone from Bend, Oregon. Katie, hi, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn, how are you?
I am good.
I am curious about making watermelon soup.
Ooh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you ever tried it?
No, I've never tried it. A friend of mine suggested it, and I did a little bit of research, and there's just all kinds of approaches and recipes, so I was curious what your thoughts might be.
Well, I do a cantaloupe soup, and watermelon would work equally as well. I'll just give you the basic idea. You take really sweet melon, okay, and you puree it with some lime zest, all right?
Okay.
And then to taste, you add a few drops of Asian fish sauce. It smells like old socks. You only need a few drops. No, see, this is the thing. It has a salty element, and it boosts everything it comes in contact with.
And just a couple drops?
If you have, let's say you have 4 cups of melon, you might use a quarter of a teaspoon. All right.
Okay.
Then you add a fair amount of lime juice. And again, you're balancing with the sweetness of the melon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with cantaloupe, it's a dense melon. So with watermelon, you have more liquid. So you may need to add a little bit more sugar. And that way you get a sweet tart effect, but you still taste watermelon. And then the last ingredient is minced chili.
Oh.
And then you have sweet melony. You have tart. You have a hint of salt. Then you have the whoop of the chili. Now, you do it to taste, and I use like fresh jalapeno, and I mince it up.
And then puree it? Or
I puree the melon, okay, and those things go into it, and then I would dice some fresh melon into the soup before you serve it, and you could even have some torn up mint leaves on top of it.
Ooh, very nice.
And it's really lovely. Now, if you take that puree and you add a shot of vodka and shake it with ice, you have a summer drink, the likes of which you pour it over a ton of ice. It has to dilute, obviously. But it's fabulous.
Soup and cocktail.
Yes. And the vodka bottle could be on the side. You know, you could drink it as just a drink.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
My neighborhood has a weekly gathering, and I am new to the neighborhood, and so this is going to be my debut.
Oh, you're going to have a ball. And it's great. It's light and it's fresh.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, you're welcome. You take care. Bye.
Bye.
You know, this is a basic thing with making fruit soups. They can be that simple. A salty element, like a little bit of fish sauce and some sugar and a lot of fresh citrus. And then something that has a pecan quality. It could be grated ginger even. You don't necessarily have to do chili, but you want a little snap. And that's it. Jerry is on the line from Beulah, North Dakota. Jerry,
what is
your pressing question?
Well, I've always been a lover of mushrooms and always keep some duck cells on hand, throw in scrambled eggs and soups and everything else.
So the chopped mushrooms that you saute, yeah.
But anyway, I got a whole bunch of dried mushrooms, porcinis and chanterelles and black trumpet.
Oh, boy.
And some matsutake. I just love how intense the flavor of the dried mushrooms is compared to the fresh little white things you get.
Yeah.
And I've been using them in soups and risottos. And what else can I do with them that really highlights that intense flavor?
You know, this is the interesting thing about whenever you dry something, it's like roasting vegetables. They get more intense in flavor. And whenever you dry something, you just concentrate its flavors. They become this rock'em sock'em example of themselves. So, you know, one of the things, because they're expensive, you can stretch them out. But you could do a mushroom ragu, and you could eat that on its own. You could add broth to it, and it could become a delicious mushroom soup. You could toss it with pasta or, you know, put it on rice. You see where I'm going? It can be anything. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go for sort of the Mediterranean version of this. This would be, you'd film a skillet in olive oil, you saute up minced onion, minced carrot, a bit of minced celery, and those white mushrooms, like maybe a pound of them. Meanwhile, you've soaked in warm water the dried mushrooms, maybe even if you want to splurge, an ounce or two of them, which is a lot, okay? Mm-hmm. Chop them up, and then they go into that saute, okay? And now what you're going to do is you're going to pour in a bit of white wine and garlic and a little bit of tomato paste, and you're going to cook that down to absolutely nothing. Keep scraping up all the brown bits at the bottom of the pan. And you could have some thyme in there and some bay leaf and a few strips of orange rind. Then you're going to strain the liquid from all those soaked mushrooms, and you're going to add that to the pan, and you're going to cook that down to nothing. Taste it for seasoning, and you should be there. And you'll have a delicious mushroom ragu with an overtone of wine and some herbs.
Sounds great.
Now, you could add cream. You could do a bit of broth. You see, but you really want to do mushroom on mushroom with a little celery, carrot, and onion, not a huge amount. The mushrooms are the main event.
Right.
And the white mushroom is your stretcher. You know, it's the bulk out. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
You take care. Bye.
Okay.
Betsy's on the line from Pittsburgh. Betsy, hi. Betsy, am I right? Is this the time of year when there are these great festivals where I can get kolache?
Yes, my dear, they are. Yeah. You have hit the nail on the head.
I remember heading to the airport, and it was in the middle of downtown, and there were all of these stands selling kolache, which, you know, to an Italian is really a glorified, very delicious ravioli.
You are absolutely correct. This is just nothing but dough things.
Yeah. Oh, brother. Do you like them?
But of course.
Oh, I mean, I had to ask. I bribed the cab driver. I bribed him to stop by telling him I'd buy him a plate. And I thought the man was going to cry. So we sat there, the two of us, with our plates of kolache swimming in butter. It was just so good.
I am so glad you had a wonderful experience here.
I love Pittsburgh. But I think you called for a reason other than to talk about my obsession with kolache.
I did, actually, because I am a member of the Herb Society of America. We do two different things in our unit. First of all, we love herbs, and second of all, we love to eat. And we eat very well. So every month we have our meeting, and we have a new member who is vegan. We have a lot of members who are vegetarian,
right.
But this, to me, has been a challenge. And I thought, okay, a vegan. And this is someone who, as you know, does not eat any animal products.
That's right. That's right.
To the point
yes.
where they don't even eat honey, because this is a product from bees.
Yeah.
Can you give me a couple of ideas as to how to go about bringing a potluck dinner to our meeting? We're kind of hummused out. We're kind of pastaed out. We're lentiled out.
I understand. I understand.
We're looking for something just a little different.
Well, I say let's go to Morocco.
Okay.
good
place to go.
Yeah, and I'm thinking
good
of
place.
The kind of dish that's good warm, or it's good, you know, at room temperature. And it's the sort of thing that begs to be topped with chopped fresh herbs. I do a green bean stew that keeps taking on different flavorings depending on what mood I'm in, but the system is always exactly the same. This is the key. You need a big skillet. Film it with olive oil. This is the way every Casper recipe begins. The big skillet, film it with olive oil. Have a lot of garlic handy that you've chopped, a nice big onion that you've chopped. Now you're going to throw the chopped onion and a pound and a half or so of trimmed green beans in there, and you're going to really cook them with salt and pepper until they're actually starting to color. And the onions are going to be really, really, you know, starting to brown. And then chopped garlic goes in. I would put in a couple of baskets of squash cherry tomatoes, okay?
Ooh.
But let the garlic go in first, along with herbs. Now, this is where I would use thyme, I would use basil, and then I do a spice blend, and I make it in a coffee grinder. It's a cinnamon stick, a tablespoon and a half maybe of whole allspice, several cloves. There's some nutmeg in it. There's a fair amount of black pepper, and then there's a bit of cumin in it.
Oh, this is excellent.
Yeah, you see where I'm going with this? If you look at any Moroccan recipe, you're going to see the direction I'm going and the spice blend, and there's paprika in it, or chili, in the sense that it can be sweet or it can be sweet and hot, depending on what you think people are going to like. Mm-hmm. So you let that cook in, okay, and then you start adding a little bit of white wine to that. Now, this is where it goes away from Morocco because I'm using alcohol. You could use a vegetable broth as well. You cook that down to nothing. You add a little more. You cook it down to nothing. Then the tomatoes go in. And then I put in enough liquid, whatever form it may be, to almost cover the beans, because then we're going to cover them. We're going to let them cook until they're just about done. They can be melting almost. And then you boil it all off so that you get this really thick, lovely stew. You could have carrot sticks in there. You could have other things as well. But the green beans are the key. And you could put chickpeas. That's the other thing. Now, when you serve this, you take mint and coriander and you chop that up. And if you have basil, you do basil. And that goes all over the top. And then you stud it with wedges of lemon, because the finish when you put it on your plate is a squeeze of fresh lemon. Now that's
this is
a feast. It is a dish unto itself. It is not trying to be meat. It's not trying to be anything than what it is. Now you put that over whole wheat couscous or rice, and you know, dinner is ready. You have no problem.
Thank you so much.
You are
this
welcome.
Will be excellent.
Thank you, ma'am. I greatly appreciate that.
Okay. Have a good weekend, honey. Thank you so much.
You
for
too, and
to
have
me.
A kolache on me.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, bye,
Betsy. Well, I've got another trivia question for you. Who might a professional drummer and a perfectionist baker have in common? Well, it could be Vic Firth. Now, he's the musician turned entrepreneur. Vic played percussion with the Boston Symphony for 50 years. And in the process, he discovered something about drumsticks that nobody had thought of. Well, now the Vic Firth Company manufactures those sticks, along with, of all things, pepper mills and rolling pins for serious cooks. Well, Vic joins us from Massachusetts. Vic, it's good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the drumsticks. What was this drumstick discovery?
Well, there were all kinds of quality standards that at the time when I was playing in the Boston Symphony, I felt weren't being met. And I was asked to play music and pieces that required sticks that just weren't available. So rather than keep grumbling about it, I decided to design some for myself, and that was the beginning of the stick business, which was huge. I think we made about 12 pair a month.
Were you whittling them yourself?
Well, that's what everybody thought. I had a sharp knife down in the basement, but anyway, I had a Montreal wood turner who was a great gentleman to work with, and he literally hand-turned every single stick.
What was the problem with the drumsticks?
Well, the sticks were never straight, and they were never properly paired. I began by guaranteeing them to be straight when rolled on a table.
Right.
Because all my competitors yelled and screamed, it's a natural product, and how can you guarantee it to be straight? And I said, just simply throw out the ones that aren't. And the other thing that I did was that I noticed one day, when I accidentally dropped some sticks on the cement floor, that they had a variety of pitches. And I got a little stool and sat down and started tapping and discovered that when I found two that had the identical pitch, they had the identical weight, density, moisture content. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was about 90% proof that those two sticks, whether the drummer had them in his right hand or his left hand, they were going to be perfectly balanced and would produce the same sound, because sticks of different pitches literally would produce a different sound when struck on a woodblock or a cymbal or what have you.
So you went from doing drumsticks to doing pepper mills and rolling pins. How did that happen?
Well, let me say this. For drummers, we have a 5A, a 5B, a 2B, a rock, whatever. What that means is the 5A is a lighter, thinner stick for jazz players or classical players. A 5B is for rock and rollers. A 2B is for marching on the street in a band or heavy metal.
Uh-huh.
So let's take the rolling pins. A classic 20-inch rolling pin is like the rock stick. It's the biggest one, has a lot of weight to it. I mean, each one, as I thought about them, I applied the theory of the drumstick and the weight and the balance, and that's why we have such a variety of pins, and hopefully the chefs appreciate it. And the Peppermill, it has to feel comfortable in your hand.
Yeah.
And then they're fitted with a stainless steel two-step mechanism, which first crushes the peppercorns to enhance the flavor, and then it grinds the peppercorn. So we've taken this Peppermill thing beyond where I ever thought it was going to go, and we're very proud of it.
Vic, thanks for talking with us. It's really interesting to see how you go from dropping a bunch of drumsticks to rolling pins and Peppermills. Thanks for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Vic Firth manufactures drumsticks, Peppermills, and rolling pins at the Vic Firth Company. Well, that is the show for the week, and I want to thank you for being with us. Remember, you can reach us any way that you want. You can join us on Facebook, connect with us on Twitter, or actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Now, until next time, let me leave you with a drummer joke. What's the last thing a drummer says in a band? Hey guys, why don't we try one of my songs? Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest publication, a quarterly ebook called Eating In with Lynn. You get a menu, recipes, tips, cooking lessons, and of course, opinions. Volume 2 is the big summer party. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.